Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Historians agree the famous Marshall Plan saved Europe after World War II.
Prime motivation for launching the Marshall Plan was fear of chaos in Western Europe.
But does anyone fear chaos in Haiti enough to create an equivalent development plan for one of the poorest nations in the world? To kick or kickstart Haiti when she's down? A multi-billion dollar question for the world community on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, February 1st, and The Takeaway is it the scale of the aid investment or the style and strategy of the investment that determines whether Haiti is going to have a sustainable post-earthquake future?
I'm glad I'm not the person that has to figure that out, actually.
Well,
let's get right
to the
top stories we're following this morning. President Obama will roll out a nearly $4 trillion budget later this morning, calls for billions in new spending to tackle unemployment while cutting $700 billion for domestic programs. Senior White House advisor David Axelrod tells NBC News.
President of the United States has one concern, which is how do we move this country forward? How do we get people back to work? How do we lift incomes? How do we build some security for the middle class?
When the dust settles, the federal deficit will rise to a record $1.6 trillion this year. That's almost 11% of the nation's gross domestic product. Economists generally agree that deficits above 3% are unsustainable. Toyota is telling dealers they should get the parts to fix problematic gas pedals later this week, but the millions of drivers who own the affected cars and trucks will have to wait for repairs. Toyota's president of U.S. sales, Jim Lent, says technicians have to be trained first.
We have the fix that our dealers are ready. Our dealers are going to be working weekends. Some dealers, as you understand, are going to be working 24/7 to be able to take care of the customers.
Lentz was speaking earlier this morning on NBC.
Flights carrying injured Haitians to the U.S. for medical treatment will resume today. They'd been suspended for several days after hospitals in Florida complained they were overloaded. All week long, we're thinking about Haiti, long after the earthquake devastation, and trying to contemplate what sort of future Haiti has and what kind of investment is required to deliver it. Joining us is economics professor Paul Collier. He's also United Nations Special Advisor on Haiti. Good morning, Professor Collier.
Good morning. Thanks
so
for inviting me.
Here's a hard-edged question. Is building a tent city in Haiti, however many lives it saves, a real investment in the nation's future?
No, we can do better than tents.
And what would that be?
We can integrate. We can build housing that will last, and we can locate it where jobs will be found.
So aid should never be short-term, should always be long-term, otherwise Haiti doesn't have a chance this century.
That's right. Aid at the first step has to be the first step in a staircase that leads to the long term.
Well, we're going to ascend that staircase with Paul Collier, economics professor and United Nations Special Advisor on Haiti, when our discussion continues in just a moment.
Police in Iraq say at least 41 people have been killed after a female suicide bomber detonated an explosives belt while walking among Shiite pilgrims in Baghdad. Talks between U.S. and Russian negotiators have resumed in Geneva this morning on a new nuclear arms deal. The long-running talks look to limit the number of nuclear warheads on each side that they can deploy.
Personal incomes up more than expected. Consumer spending is also higher for the third straight month. That's according to new numbers out last hour. The Commerce Department says incomes rose by 0.4% in December, the sixth increase in a row, and that may be moving the markets later this morning. It was ladies' night at the Grammys last night. Did you stay up to see that Beyoncé was the big winner? She took home a record 6 awards, but she lost Album of the Year to country star Taylor Swift, who won 4 awards herself. Asian markets up. European indices are mixed. Not on the Taylor Swift news, though. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,067. The S&P opens at 1,073. And the NASDAQ opens at 2147. This morning, we're welcoming our new listeners in Miami on WLRN. And later this hour, columnist Dave Barry tells us what the rest of the nation should know about the city. Other than the Golden Girls are from there.
Were they?
Oh, yeah.
We're also looking at the president's budget and asking you, how do you budget? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Good morning, everyone. We've seen it these past 3 weeks. The earthquake in Haiti and its aftermath have dominated the headlines. Pictures of devastation and hope. Frustrated survivors hanging on to an international lifeline. The aid telethons, military airlifts. Haiti, though, beyond these headlines, is a challenge for the 21st century. A challenge not unlike the challenge facing the international community at the end of World War II. Here's the voice of then-Secretary of State George Marshall calling for massive investment to rebuild war-ravaged Europe.
This unprecedented endeavor of the new world to help the old is neither sure nor easy. It is a calculated risk. It is a difficult program. And you know far better than I do the political difficulties involved in this program. But there's no doubt whatever in my mind that if we decide to do this thing, we can do it successfully.
Political difficulties? Successful outcome? Does the earthquake disaster in Haiti call for a Marshall Plan style investment? We're joined by Paul Collier once again, special advisor to Haiti with the United Nations Secretary General in 2009 and author of the book The Bottom Billion, Why the Poorest Countries Are Failing and What Can Be Done About It. Once again, Professor Collier, good morning.
Good morning.
So you described a staircase of aid strategies that get beyond the short term and move into sort of long-term sustainable development. Let me ask you right off the top, is Haiti a hard problem or is Haiti a relatively easy problem? And I made the comparison to the Marshall Plan there at the top of the hour.
Haiti is a relatively easy problem by the standards of fragile states today. Haiti is not Afghanistan. Afghanistan, I think, is hard. Haiti, I think, is easy.
And what is it about Haiti that makes it easy? You've written that Haiti, at least on paper, has an extraordinarily productive potential in agriculture and might even actually be a place for light manufacturing. Describe.
It's full of economic opportunities. As you say, mangoes, fantastic. They're the best quality mangoes in the world. They rot on the trees just offshore from the biggest mango market on Earth. So getting the logistics of getting those mangoes to market, that's not rocket science. It can be done, and that's a big livelihood earner for Haitians.
And there's also coffee, right?
There's coffee. So within agriculture, mangoes are just an example of the commercialization of agriculture potential. In light manufacturing, Haiti's got a very good trade deal with America, Hope 2, that gives good market access for light manufacturers, garments and such like. It's got a very good workforce. There's just simple impediments like electricity, functioning ports. These things are very readily fixable. Haiti is offshore from the biggest market on Earth. Afghanistan and many countries like it are landlocked thousands of miles away from a market.
Well, let's take a look at some of the aid efforts that were well underway before this earthquake. I mean, former President Clinton famously assembled a group of private investors to put up something on the order of $200 million. But I'm wondering if that was going to be spent on precisely the things that you think are important. Development of electricity, the upgrading of the port, the creation of the kind of infrastructure that's actually going to support those businesses. As far as I can tell, it's mostly hotels and tourism.
Well, hotels and tourism is no bad thing. That's one opportunity. Haiti's got a lot of opportunity in tourism, so I don't want to knock that at all. There's also a lot of money that was committed to building factories. George Soros put up over $25 million as part of that initiative to create new factory space. So, yes, there were things happening. There should be much more happening, and now's the chance to do it on electricity in the ports. Those were the big things to fix, and they're fixable.
Without a government, though, why would private investors even go into Haiti?
Of course there's got to be a government, but but the range of what the government's got to do is not very great. Do we know how to supply electricity reliably and cheaply? Of course we do. Do we know how a port should function? Of course we do. These are doable things, and they'll be done now.
The question is really, will the Haitian people trust the government to do those sorts of things? And we've heard again and again, Paul Collier, professor of economics director of the Center for the Study of African Economics at Oxford University, we've heard time and time again that people just don't trust the Haitian government to carry out even these kinds of redevelopment efforts. And listen here, if you would, Paul Collier, to the motivations, in the words of the late historian Larry Bland, talking about the Marshall Plan, why the U.S. and ultimately the investors who went into Europe after World War II got involved.
Prime motivation for launching the Marshall Plan was fear of chaos in Western Europe. You could see this if you went to the movies every weekend on the beginning of the feature where they'd show problems in Europe on the newsreels. Starving women and children affect Americans' hearts.
So, Paul Collier, how come we don't fear chaos in Haiti as much as we feared chaos in Europe after World War II?
Well, there isn't the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons sitting next door. So the, as it were, the downside risk is smaller. But yeah, Haiti now is where Europe was in the late 40s. We forget just how fragile Europe was then. Of course, Haiti's very small. This is a very fixable problem. Sure, the Haitian government in the past has not had a good record, and it's important to build decision structures that work within Haiti and internationally. I mean, what I've been suggesting is a dual decision structure of a respected Haitian, a prime minister, a former prime minister, whatever, and a respected international leader such as Bill Clinton, who co-lead a temporary effort, maybe 3 or 4 years, where they have the power of money and the power of implementation for things like electricity in the ports.
Interesting. So a distribution of sovereignty there, that would be unprecedented, and it sounds very 21st century, if you ask me. What are the triggers we should look for that would show that, in fact, enough was in place to possibly trigger a sustainable river of private sector investment in a place like Haiti?
Well, first, let's look for sustainable housing. So not tents, but simple one-room buildings that can then be expanded down the line. Let's look for those houses to be located in places where economic opportunity can be built alongside them. So we're solving the residential problem and the jobs problem at the same time.
Permanent housing located near infrastructure that would support jobs. There's a cycle that attracts investment. Paul Collier is professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University. The idea of a Marshall Plan in Haiti, a lesson for the 20th century, here on The Takeaway. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the stories we're following.
Some positive news on the economy this morning. The Commerce Department reported in the last hour that for the third straight month, consumer spending and personal incomes went up in December. Later this morning, President Obama rolls out his nearly $4 trillion budget proposal. The plan will lead to a record $1.6 trillion deficit. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs told CNN the president hasn't forgotten about his promise to cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term.
The president is committed to keeping that goal, understanding that, as you said, this recession was deeper than we thought it was going to be.
The budget slashes funding for hundreds of federal programs and raises taxes on big banks and the wealthy. Toyota told dealers today they should get parts to fix faulty gas pedals by later this week, but the more than 4 million drivers affected by the recall will have to wait until technicians are trained before repairs can begin.
Taliban leaders in Afghanistan have told the president, Hamid Karzai, they won't consider reintegrating into Afghan society until international forces fully pull out of the country. Meanwhile, in Pakistan, the Taliban is denying reports that their leader died from injuries sustained in a U.S. drone strike last month. Finally, sports officials say they're ramping up security for Super Bowl 44 in Miami following the failed Christmas Day terror attempt. Rear Admiral Steve Branham is the federal security coordinator for this year's big game. He says teams are getting better every year.
I would say if anything's changed, it's our readiness and our ability to respond to contingencies if one should occur.
Security at the Super Bowl.
As a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning, coming up, we talk to a Toyota dealer, see how the repair process is going.
Hey, you want that to go?
So our first takeout refers to a brutal headline in the ongoing war between the drug cartels in Mexico and the Mexican government attempting to control them. The war has burst forth throughout the border region, and in Ciudad Juarez, there was a particularly brutal story over the weekend. Joining us now, Dudley Althaus, Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle, who joins us from Mexico City. Dudley, what actually happened about this attack over the weekend?
Yeah, this was particularly nasty.
as many as 15 gunmen stormed into a party being held in a poor neighborhood in Juarez and rounded up a bunch of the kids that were partying there and just started executing them. This is in a neighborhood sort of near the police station of Juarez. Parents of the children said they had absolutely nothing to do with organized crime or with the drug trade in that city, and everybody's just confused why they would have been attacked.
Well, one thing that sort of ratchets up the brutality here is apparently most of them were high school football players.
Well, a lot of them were high school football players. Some of them, one of the students that was killed, had just received an award from the state's governor for his academic achievements. These, by all accounts, were good kids.
And so the message here from the drug traffickers and the armed militia is you are not safe no matter where you are, no matter who you are. Is that fair?
That's pretty much fair, and it goes against the common wisdom here that if you're not involved in the drug trade, you're pretty much safe. And so, yeah, this is disturbing. What's even more disturbing is it's really not getting major play in the national news in Mexico.
Wow.
It's getting play, but it's kind of people are getting blasé about this sort of thing, and that's scary.
But overall, potentially a serious problem for Mexican President Felipe Calderon. Dudley Althaus reporting on the brutal situation in the drug trafficking wars down in Mexico that are constantly creating brutal scenes on the border with the United States. He's Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle.
Well, when was the last time you linked Henry Paulson with salacious literature? We're talking about former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is releasing his memoir, On the Brink, Inside the Race to Stop the Collapse of the Global Financial System. And Louise Story, our partner, for our finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is with us. So what is in this book that's surprising?
Well, you know, all of us who've covered this financial crisis and anyone on Wall Street was very avidly flipping through the pages of this book this weekend. This is the first person who is really running the response to the crisis or involved in it who's written a memoir. I mean, you've seen probably 20 books out there by journalists, but you haven't seen Dick Folds, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, write a book, and you haven't seen, you know, Tim Geithner write a book. This is the first up-close book. And there's a little, you know, you do get a sense of some of his personal moments. He tells a story that a lot of people have been talking about on Saturday, September 13th, which was the weekend Lehman was failing. He tells a story. He's a devout Christian Scientist, and he's in New York at a hotel, having been at the New York Fed all day, and he needed some sleep, and someone had given him sleeping pills. And so he tells a story. He's in there, and he's holding the pill, and he's about to take it, but then he flushes it down the toilet because he wants to rely on his prayer to sleep. So there's personal moments like that. But there's also big headline revelations. One big revelation is that apparently in August of 2008, when Russia was at war with Georgia, which is a U.S. ally, apparently Paulson was told that Russia had gone to the Chinese government and said to them, you know, we both own a lot of Fannie and Freddie bonds. Let's just dump them in the market. Russia and China, let's dump all those Fannie and Freddie bonds in the market to cause havoc and bring those companies down. And apparently China refused to participate in this. But this is one of the revelations in his book.
What did he say? He said some things about the election race.
He did. So he, you know, of course, was talking to the candidates, and he said that he was impressed by how engaged Obama seemed, and Obama would call him up all the time and seemed really engaged. And he did, even though he's a Republican, he was part of the Bush administration, he did say that McCain and Palin just did not seem to be very engaged, didn't call him much, and he said it kind of bothered them that Palin called him Hank.
I guess folksy didn't work on former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Louise Story's business reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
So at last count, Toyota has recalled 6 million cars and trucks affected by a faulty gas pedal, and to repair it, the company is telling everyone help is on the way.
We have the fix that our dealers are ready. Our dealers are going to be working weekends. Some dealers, as you understand, are going to be working 24/7. They will take care of the customers.
That's Jim Lentz, President and Chief Operating Officer of Toyota Motor Sales, on NBC News this morning. But joining us now is John McElhaney, a Toyota dealer in Iowa and chairman of the National Association of Automobile Dealers. So is that what they're telling you? Work 24/7, John?
Well, what they're telling us, John, is to, and dealers, I think, agree with this with Toyota, is to get on this as quickly as possible. As soon as the parts are in, affected customers will be notified, and we want to try. And I think the problem is out there, and I think the best we can make of it is to deal with it as quickly and as efficiently as possible to reduce customers' unrest. So that's kind of what we're charged with doing.
Now, you know, accidents can happen to anyone, any auto company, but with the culture of Toyota and its sense of reliability, I don't want to drag you out of your PR comfort zone, John McElhaney, but I mean, what's it like to face Toyota owners who really have never been accustomed to this sort of thing before?
Well, I've been a Toyota dealer for 36 years. I've had other franchises, GM, Hyundai, and Chrysler. And, you know, the recalls are not unusual. This one has gotten a lot of visibility because it is Toyota, and their reputation is that they're bulletproof and their quality and reliability is very good. But they are very focused on safety. I think one of the reasons it made them successful and the fact that they grew so rapidly in this country is because of those standards that they have. And those are shared by their dealers. So I think it's going to be, it is difficult in the short term, but I think the long-term impact of this will not be devastating by any means. I think we'll get past it.
Is that because this is an easy fix?
Well, it's that's part of it. You know, that's of the millions of vehicles recalled, we believe there's a very small number that actually were affected, but no one knows that for sure, and you have to exercise caution. So hopefully we can give customers reassurance by handling it in the proper way.
Well, good luck. Get some sleep, John. John McElhaney, Toyota and GM dealer and chairman of the National Association of Automobile Dealers. Coming up, we're going to go to California where there's a crisis developing.
At least 5 infants were born with either cleft palate or cleft lip.
What's the EPA doing about it? We'll talk about that in just a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. You know, the front lines in environmental justice today might be a tiny town in California where a health epidemic could be a crisis that needs intervention from the Environmental Protection Agency. We'll talk about that in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories you're following at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama will propose a nearly $4 trillion budget this morning. That includes a $100 billion jobs package, plus more education spending and higher taxes on big banks and families earning more than $250,000 a year. All in all, the federal deficit will rise to a record $1.6 trillion this year. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs tells CNN they know that's a big number, but
We are not creating the jobs that we'd like to, and I think that some additional recovery and stimulus spending is important.
Along with $700 billion in cuts, there'll also be a spending freeze for many domestic programs. Toyota is telling dealers they'll get the parts they need to fix problematic gas pedals later this week, but more than 4 million customers are affected by the recall, and they're going to have to wait until technicians are trained to get it fixed. In the meantime, dealerships will be open for extended hours.
Flights carrying injured Haitians to the United States for medical treatment will resume today. They'd been suspended for several days after hospitals in Florida complained they were overloaded. Meanwhile, 10 Americans detained on suspicion of trying to take 33 children out of Haiti without permission will be in court today. The group says there was miscommunication over paperwork. Some positive news on the economy this morning. The Commerce Department reported in the last hour that for the third straight month, consumer spending and personal incomes went up in December. And looking at the markets, the futures were positive all morning, and that's continuing as Wall Street opens. Trading begins. The Dow's up about 60 points, the S&P up about 6, and the NASDAQ is up almost 10 points as Wall Street gets started this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following.
Kettleman City, California is a small community of mostly Spanish-speaking residents. It's making national headlines, though, because there's been an epidemic of birth defects. They're described here by Kettleman City resident Marciela Melis Alatorre.
In the past 2 years, we've had 6 babies born with cleft palate in our town, which is a really small town. It's a town of 1,500. We know that the normal incidence of cleft palate is 1 birth in every 1,000. As it stands, we're way over what's considered the norm.
The residents of Kettleman City realize the birth defects may be the result of a giant toxic waste company right near town that's dumping PCBs into the water. The battle for the remedy has become a case study in environmental protection. Joining us now to talk about the possible shift in policy for the EPA is Jeff Young. He's the host of Public Radio International's Living on Earth, and he's here to tell us what this small town reveals about the EPA under President Obama. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, let's give some more details about this story coming out of California. Bradley Angels, the executive director of Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice, it's been critical of the EPA because, as he told The Takeaway, the EPA has ignored this problem of chemical waste in California.
For decades, you know, EPA has always said they support environmental justice. After all, they have a legal commitment to do so. For decades, they've not only ignored that commitment, they've violated it, literally talking out of both sides of their mouth. EPA has been, I guess one way of saying asleep at the wheel, but it's actually worse. They've been complicit. For example, in Kettleman City, letting chem waste dump even more polychlorinated biphenols, PCBs, really toxic chemicals, on a permit that should have expired 12 years ago. I mean, that should never happen.
So Jeff Young, host of PRI's Living on Earth, first let's kind of unpack what he's saying there. Has the, well, obviously this investigation into this chemical waste dump is not going to determine whether or not the EPA has been complicit in allowing it to happen, but have they allowed some things to slip by in terms of regulation?
Well, I think there's no question but that we've heard complaints for a long time from what are often called fence line communities. These are the places that happen to be right beside either a dump or a chemical facility or petrochemical facility. And there are pockets of these communities all across the country that suffer disproportionately the impacts of waste or effluent or emissions. And for whatever reason, those tend to get lower priority. And it's often assumed that these are because these are disenfranchised communities that don't have a strong political voice. And that's the goal of environmental justice and the EPA's environmental justice program. Now, under new leadership here with Obama's administrator, Lisa Jackson, there's been a lot of rhetoric about taking more seriously the environmental justice mission of EPA. I think that this case in California may give us some early indication as to whether or not they're going to make it more than rhetoric.
How much people are talking about this is a major shift in policy for the EPA. Is that rhetoric, or if they go through and investigate this and follow through, is this actually a real shift towards pursuing environmental justice?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. You know, these problems are very complicated, though, and I would warn against very high expectations. The people who actually suffer here, they have a strong desire to get concrete answers. What's going on? I mean, we know from what's been uncovered so far in the Kettleman case that these people are suffering a disproportionate number of children born with birth defects. The numbers are there. Now, exactly why? That's where it's going to get murky, and the answers are going to be, I predict, frustrating for the people who are directly affected. And so it's unfair, I think, to expect that you're going to get concrete answers quickly. However, in a broader sense, I think this is an indication that EPA is moving toward taking environmental justice more seriously, toward targeting these things. The other big and messy part of this is the whole Superfund program, which is responsible for cleaning up a lot of these sites. It's been fairly moribund, underfunded. We're going to need to look to the Obama administration's budget, which is coming out today for EPA, to see exactly what they intend to put behind cleanup of sites like these.
Well, you know, the mission of the EPA is a broad one. It just says protect human health and the environment. So if the EPA is, if environmental justice is just part of what they do, what else are they doing for protecting human health?
Well, now that is a broad topic. Overall, you know, because we're 1 year into the administration here, I think that the key elements have been in elevating the priority of clean energy and climate change, which is a work in progress, to put it mildly, but we've seen a lot of progress along those lines, particularly the investments made by the Stimulus Act, which are record-setting in terms of trying to develop research and development on clean energy technologies. And Lisa Jackson at EPA has promised a long overdue reform of toxic chemical regulation, a system that people on both sides of the debate, the industry and the public health advocates, both say is a broken system. This so-called TSCA, the toxic chemical law, is just antiquated and needs reform.
But Jeff Young, just for the people of Kettleman City, I mean, is the EPA responsible for determining PCB levels in their drinking water, or is that just left to lawyers to figure out?
Well, EPA has a strong role here, and I think it's interesting that the regional administrator has taken a strong role on this. And that tells you something about EPA. It doesn't always happen equally at all places. So Kettleman City is getting some action. I think there are other communities around the country who face similar issues who are saying, hey, what about us? And perhaps they'll now step up and demand more action.
Jeff Young is the host of PRI's Living on Earth program. Thanks so much, Jeff. Coming up, welcome to new listeners on WLRN in Miami. What does the rest of the country need to know about your city? Miami-based columnist Dave Barry says there's a lot that people need to know about Miami. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
If you could tell everybody,
at the Grammys last night, Elton John, one legend, Lady Gaga, a wannabe legend, both of them singing, performing at the awards ceremony, both with fake hair completely, probably the only thing they have in common. Karen Gantz, deputy editor of RollingStone.com, joins us to sort of recap the Grammy Awards last night. Lady Gaga was a spectacle and was certainly the talk of the awards, but really the award goes to Beyonce for getting a record for women performers, and there were some other things to talk about as well. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. Yeah, Beyonce won 6 of her 10 nominations. That's a record for the most wins by a woman in a single night at the Grammys. Pretty impressive.
You know, if you take Taylor Swift, who won Album of the Year, and Beyonce and Lady Gaga and sort of set them as a kind of pantheon of the music industry 2010, you couldn't find three bigger contrasts.
Absolutely. I mean, Beyonce is really about the perfection of the performance. Taylor Swift is kind of about songwriting craft and, you know, youthful exuberance. And Lady Gaga is kind of about the crazy, ugly side of fame.
And there's plenty of crazy, ugly side of fame that's driving record sales as much as fabulous songs, Taylor Swift, and the veteran powerhouse of a Beyonce.
It's true. You know, as women are really ruling the charts this year, they had all the top records. And I think part of that has to do with that women are very popular in pop music, and pop music does well in a singles environment, which is kind of where we're heading. The industry has a big problem selling albums, but they're okay selling singles.
So how do you explain the fact that the Kings of Leon won? Somebody. Guys have to get some awards, I guess, huh?
They do, actually. They had an awesome year, too. They were one of the best new rock bands around. And that song actually had a lot of pop appeal. It was played on pop radio. It was covered by Kelly Clarkson. But it's also just a really solid, kind of bluesy ballad.
Does the Grammy Awards in tone last night bespeak recovery in the music industry or still a sense of crisis? There were a lot of, you know, really diverse performers. Record sales are doing really well in a lot of sectors. Concert sales are good.
I think it was a pretty hopeful Grammys overall. I mean, as you were saying, the bent was towards youth. Last year, Robert Plant walked away with the most awards. You know, he's awesome. But I think this year the focus was more on the next generation, you know, really looking at where the industry is heading.
What was your favorite moment last night?
I know, I really did like that Lady Gaga Elton John performance. It kind of just showed how she's an amazing pop performer. She's out there dancing, and then 2 seconds later, she makes herself physically unappealing and dirty. And she's at the piano, you know, showing off against one of the greatest pianists ever. It was pretty amazing.
And keeping Elton John's career alive. You know, Elton should thank her, don't you think?
Well, they both like glitter.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's true. And Taylor Swift, I mean, does this mean that next year she's a powerhouse that continues or flash in the pan?
Well, she's going on tour, a really big tour next year. I mean, she had the biggest selling album of 2009 with Fearless. I don't think she's a flash in the pan. I think her performance was a little bit weaker on the vocals, but she's very beloved. She's a very charming, appealing personality. I think we're going to see a lot of her.
And nothing can stop Beyonce.
Nothing can ever stop Beyonce. She's one of my favorites. I mean, everything about her performance just speaks to perfection. She's really sharp.
Quentin Tarantino said hip-hop is not dead in introducing Eminem and Lil Wayne. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, hip-hop is one of the most vital forms of music we have going on today. That was a pretty awesome performance, despite the censors.
Yes, massive censors. You lost about 2 minutes of it because of the obscenities, but it was great. Karen Gantz, deputy editor of RollingStone.com, recapping the Grammys, and we'll recap some Drake right here. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee, and welcome to WLRN listeners in Miami. They joined the Takeaway family this morning, and to celebrate all things Miami, we talk with the noted personal trainer and South Florida brain surgeon. He's also a columnist at the Miami Herald, Dave Barry. He'll be with us in just a moment. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The Commerce Department is reporting that consumer spending went up for the third straight month, while personal incomes were up for the sixth month in a row. People may be spending more, but jobs are still hard to come by, and the president will be focusing on that when he unveils his nearly $4 trillion budget this morning. It would put about $100 billion into fighting unemployment, but it would also push the deficit to about $1.6 trillion. Our partner, the New York Times, says the White House wants to overhaul President Bush's education law, No Child Left Behind, in this budget process. The White House wants to change the way the program is financed so that a portion of the money is awarded based solely on academic progress. Toyota USA President Jim Lentz appeared on this morning's news shows to update customers on the latest in the recall situation.
The training has already taken place at our dealerships. Parts will be shipping today. So I think by later on this week, we will begin the process of notification to bring customers.
Government regulators say they are satisfied with the plan to repair accelerator pedals.
In the publishing business, Amazon.com is giving in to pricing demands from publisher Macmillan on electronic books. Prices for Macmillan ebook bestsellers will likely increase between $3 and $5. Moving abroad now, police in Iraq say at least 41 people have been killed after a female suicide bomber blew herself up while walking among Shiite pilgrims in northern Baghdad. And in Haiti, aid agencies are rushing to find thousands of children made homeless by the earthquake, many of whom are roaming the streets. And also, 10 Americans will be in court today on suspicion of trying to take 33 children out of the country without permission. We got more details on this case from BBC reporter Nick Davis. He joined us earlier from Port-au-Prince.
Well, at the moment, it's pretty unclear as to what exactly is going to happen. They still have to go before a commission meeting at some point later on today, just to find out whether or not they're actually going to face charges and what might actually happen if they're going to go before a judge and actually take some form of responsibility over what happened.
Who are the kids and where are they at this point?
At the moment, they're being looked after by SOS Children's Villages, a charity, an Austrian charity based in Port-au-Prince on the outskirts. The children, it seems as if they were taken from an area, or if anything, picked up from an area not far from here, Delmar. From what we're gathering, it seems as if these children were introduced by the people from New Life Children's Refuge by a local Haitian pastor. From there on in, we're very unclear as to what actually happened. The charity say that they were actually children from an orphanage. They were taken from an orphanage and they didn't have parents. But we're hearing very, very contradictory sort of messages coming out. One of the children apparently saying that she had parents and that as far as she was concerned, she was being taken to a boarding school, a summer camp.
Okay, and this is Nick Davis, correspondent for our partner, the BBC in Haiti, with a rooster behind him telling him to get to work. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Good morning, Miami. We are welcoming Miami listeners to The Takeaway this week at WLRN. There is no one sound of Miami. That's the Afro-Cuban sound of Mario Bauza, who actually broke the color line performing live in Miami back in the 1940s. But there are many Miamis, and we want to bring them to you all this week as we welcome our new listeners. And to begin, we're going to talk with Dave Barry, the Miami-based Pulitzer Prize-winning humor columnist. He's a legend in Miami and outside of Miami. He's the author of I'll Mature When I'm Dead. That's his latest book, Dave Barry's Amazing Tales of Adulthood. It'll be out this May. Dave, good morning.
Hey, John, how are you?
Pretty good. Are the people of Miami going to forgive us for first day on the air and we get you?
Not the Chamber of Commerce. No, I don't think so.
Really?
No, I consider myself an ambassador for Miami. I love this city, and I've loved it ever since I moved here in 1986 from the United States. It's just different, you know. It's like people have a bad image of the city, and I personally would like to correct. There's a poll they do, the Zogby people do,
right?
Where they ask, you know, people what their views of what their impressions of certain areas are. And in Miami, one of the things people always say is they think of it as a dangerous, violent place. And those of us who live here are hurt by that. We want to track those people down and kill them because
right.
it's a wonderful.
Right.
city.
Yeah,
I love it.
And that would be helpful. Now, we met years and years ago when
we did at the airport.
That's right, at the airport.
Did you ever catch that flight?
I did catch the flight. But you had gone to New York to do a piece about something the New York Times did in the magazine called "Can Miami Save Itself?" And you marched up with the expense account of the Miami Herald to do "Can New York Save Itself?" There's a tradition of you and Miami kind of saying, "Hey, stick it to the rest of the country" when they criticize Miami. Why is that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like we know we have our flaws, but that was pretty funny. That was a situation, I believe it was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And New York was not exactly an earthly paradise in the 80s.
Indeed.
And we had this well-known problem with big-time drug dealing and all going on for a while down here. And New York Times discovered it like 10 years after this gigantic front page story, "Can Miami Save Itself?" And so that we thought would be, you know, that's very polite and unkind of New York to find that we have flaws. We have a longstanding sort of antagonism here for the New Yorkers. I am one of them. I'm a New Yorker originally, but I don't do what a lot of my fellow New Yorkers do, which is come down here, live here, spend the rest of their lives here, and never stop complaining about how much better the York is, and our feeling is, okay, go on back, you know, go get on that number two subway if you really liked it that much, but we're fine here.
You know, when I was reporting in Chicago back in the 80s, Chicago was a great story. It was an international city. It also had a real sense of its identity. Miami, I think, is a similar kind of story. It has an intense sort of connection with the rest of the world, certainly in the Western Hemisphere, but there's something about Miami that also helps not simply a journalist, but a columnist get ahead. I mean, you and Carl Hyacin find more fantastic, almost unbelievable stories to tell about Miami. It seems like there's no place else in the world like it.
That's true. There's a whole genre of South Florida crime fiction. And as Carl Hyacin has said many times, you don't need an imagination. You just need a subscription to the newspaper. We had a story. Okay. I mean, we could do nothing for the next hour, but I could tell you. But I'll just tell you one. This happened last year.
Okay.
And it was made the Miami Herald. There was a shark, a live shark, on our people mover. a couple of guys had been fishing in Biscayne Bay and caught a 6-foot nurse shark, and they wanted to sell it at one of the fish wholesalers downtown. And I guess this is why we have a people mover. I don't know why we don't just call it the shark mover. But anyway, they thought, well, we'll just take public transportation with this shark. So they got – and the shark was still alive at this point. I apologize to all the animal lovers out there, but this is a true story. The shark was alive when they got on the train with it. And I got an email from a commuter who she took a picture of the shark with her phone and sent it to me. She said, "This is Miami. There's a live shark on the train." So we could have theoretically had a situation where somebody was bitten by a shark. It didn't happen. And I just want to stress that to visitors. There have been zero shark bites on the people mover in Miami, whatever you may have heard. But that's a story that is unlikely to occur in, say, Cleveland.
And emblematic of a city where you just said you don't need an imagination to tell an amazing story. But then it's, of course, the location of Disney World, right?
That's a low blow, John. No, we don't even talk about it.
He's speechless.
Are you speechless?
But you know, these columnists that we're talking about, including yourself, you guys pick on Miami. It's when other people pick them on Miami that you have a problem.
That's right, because they're not down here dodging bullets with us. That's our feeling.
Well, we are thrilled to have Miami part of the voice of the Takeaway. Who do you imagine will be the first listener who calls our spin box number, 877-8-MY-TAKE, to tell us about something that's going on in Miami?
I don't know that they'll call. They may just show up in person.
And we would love that. We would love that. Actually, 160 Varick Street is our address here in New York City. Dave, you come and visit us sometime, all right?
Yeah, good luck with the show down here.
Well, thanks, Dave. Dave Barry, humor columnist and author of numerous books, based in Miami, Florida, and a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. Welcome, Miami and WLRN.
For any of you in Miami or elsewhere, if you missed something on the show, you can get our podcast. That's at thetakeaway.org. And while the president's sending his budget to Congress, he's looking to cut back. And we're asking, what advice would you give President Obama? How do you trim your own budget? And what lessons have you learned?
Hi, my name's Lynn Seegers. I'm calling from Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. The way that I track my budget is I got a starting point. I figured out how much do I spend on everything up to a year. Expenses you know you're going to have every single year. And then I get paid every week, so I just broke it down how much has to come out every week. And I track it on a spreadsheet. And then when that bill comes due, I always have the money ready to pay for it.
Wow, now that is organized. How do you do it?
Depressing.
Why is that depressing?
Oh, my God.
See, I find that invigorating. I want to be that organized.
I could never. She is Mount Everest. I am the Dead Sea.
So you're very salty and low elevation, is what
you're
saying.
Yeah, you can figure it out.
8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.